Captain Jack comes to our door. We won't have to dread the poorhouse anymore.
Good morning, I'm Loreto Rojas.
And I'm Cal Winslow, and this is Talking About California. And this morning we're taking up a new issue, the Green New Deal. And we should say a word about this. For 2 years now, we've been covering the situation on the southern border and closely related topics.
We had never intended to cover just one topic, but had no idea of the depth of this crisis, nor did we understand that this crisis would continue. So much so we learned just 2 weeks ago from our guest Bardis Vakili that the situation remains as serious, as horrific as ever.
Still, there are other issues that we've wanted to cover, so it's only very reluctantly that we leave the situation behind, however temporarily. And listeners, if you have any ideas to share on this, we'd love to know what you think.
So this morning, we begin several programs on the Green New Deal and on the direction of the U.S. economy and, by implication, the faith of the earth.
And our first guest will be known to many of you. We're very pleased this morning to talk with Richard Walker.
Richard Walker is a professor emeritus of geography at the University of California, Berkeley, where he taught from 1975 to 2012. Professor Walker has written on a diverse range of topics in economic, urban, and environmental geography, with scores of published articles to his credit.
He's co-author of The Capitalist Imperative and The New Social Economy. He's written extensively on California, including The Conquest of Bread, The Country and the City, and The Atlas of California.
His latest book, Pictures of a Gone City, Tech and the Dark Side of Prosperity in the San Francisco Bay Area, should be required reading for everyone in Northern California.
And now Dick Walker is the director of the Living New Deal Project, a project whose purpose is to inventory all New Deal public work sites in the United States and recover the lost memory of government investment for the good of all. Walker now splits time between Berkeley and Burgundy when he's not visiting us in Mendocino.
Good morning, Richard.
Good morning, Lily. Very glad to be back with you. Always fun to talk to you and your listeners.
Dick, I wonder if we could get started with your interest in the New Deal. You've been involved with this project, the Living New Deal, for some time now, longer, I think, than there's been a movement for a Green New Deal. So can you tell us about that so we can talk about the, let's say, the old New Deal, what it was, what it did, what you think was important about it?
Well, briefly, what we've been doing is primarily documenting all the public works that the New Deal built. And it turns out there's literally hundreds of thousands. And we've documented about 16,000, which seems like a lot, but we're still scratching the surface nationwide. It's quite amazing. Now, of course, many of those are humble, but many of them are very dramatic, like the Triborough Bridge in New York or the Jefferson Memorial in Washington, D.C. But when you add them all up, it's an amazing legacy. And as we've done this, we've also tried to create a website and create a sort of information clearinghouse for thoughts about the New Deal, which turns out to be extremely relevant for today, as we see with the Green New Deal program. We knew that from the beginning in a way, but I don't think we understood even how much there was out there, how little is known about it, how pretty much Americans have forgotten what the New Deal did, except for a couple of highlights. And so it's really important, we find, to try to educate the public about this amazing moment in U.S. political history and social history and economic history that really changed the country. And it's the kind of thing, you know, could happen again because it happened before. So I think there's a lot of very useful things to be learned from what they were able to do in the 1930s.
So let's begin with a little history lesson. What was the New Deal? What is, you know, is found behind it? Why did we have that period of history?
Well, of course, the big problem at the time was the Great Depression, which started under Herbert Hoover in 1929, and by 1933, when Franklin Roosevelt entered office as president, the economy had shrunk by about a third, about a quarter of the labor force was unemployed, and misery was pretty widespread and political upheaval. So Roosevelt promised in his speeches as a candidate that he would offer the American people a New Deal. Now, what exactly he thought by that is not all that clear because he didn't have a blueprint. And I think one of the things that's interesting about it is how pragmatic Roosevelt and his advisors, people like Harry Hopkins and Francis Perkins and all, were in addressing the problems they saw before them. And they just kind of went out and did it. And they realized that the country was in deep trouble. The people were in deep trouble. The economy was a disaster. And they just kind of jumped in and started coming up with programs.
Like?
Well, it's quite amazing because, you know, most people know of things like the WPA, Works Progress Administration, and the CCC, Civilian Conservation Corps.
I don't think that's true. Professor, I don't think that's true.
I think people have heard of it. No,
yeah.
When I mention them, when people, you give talks to someone, people go, oh, yeah, no, I've heard of that.
Yeah.
And they probably heard of Social Security, created under the New Deal, and labor law, the modern labor law system was created under the New Deal, and a whole series of things. Minimum wages were first introduced under the New Deal, for example. So it ends up being something like 60 different laws and programs that were passed during the 1930s, from 33 to 39. Pretty much the New Deal was wound down by 1941, 1942. So it's basically a decade. And, you know, we can go into what those programs all added up to, but it's quite amazing how many they were and how most people's knowledge of that period just scratches the surface.
So what we know as about this New Deal are actually things that I'm going to disagree here with Carl, of some things that we really know and value, like minimal wage and the Social Security system, which we many of us take for granted, but it was created at that time, right, to protect the most vulnerable people at that moment.
That's right. And there are other things you probably everybody's heard of, like bank insurance, deposit insurance at your bank, which was also created by the New Deal. So to make this a little more comprehensible, I usually break down the things they did into four areas. One was the economic revival and regulation. Another one was programs for the people. A third was investment and modernization of infrastructure and so forth. And the last one is political revival, political renewal, and actually rescuing American democracy.
Okay, well, let's go back to number one.
Okay. So economic revival and regulation. The economy was in terrible shape, and the New Deal stepped in with a series of reforms, some of them legislated, some of them by executive order, that cleaned up things, put the system on a good financial footing, so that it could start growing again. So, for example, there's financial house cleaning of a banking system that was coming apart, of a stock market that had been plagued with fraud, and so on. And so they cleaned up the banks, bought in deposit insurance, and solidified the dollar and so on. Now, that was essential because without a good financial system, you can't get credit and the economy pretty much stops. That's what almost happened in 2008 when the financial system collapsed. So it's not something most of us remember or think is very important, but it was pretty fundamental. Then they spent. They invested like hell. They in infrastructure. They were government spending, federal spending, but also states went up dramatically. They ran deficits for the first time in peacetime. And so they were able to inject a lot of government spending to stimulate the economy. So it was a stimulus package. And along with that stimulus, something like what Obama did and when he came in with the TARP program, to basically big infrastructure. But the other thing they did was relief and of it for the unemployed, because people were desperate and because there was this massive unemployment. So they created these relief employment programs, jobs programs, which, as I'll explain later, were not just make work, but really doing very important work. And these were the, there's a whole series of them, Civil Works Administration, Federal Emergency Relief Administration, WPA, and so on. And they hired, over the course of the 30s, about 15 million people, usually 6 months, a year, sometimes 2 years, who were on the unemployment rolls. And so they saved a lot of people's lives that way. And, of course, it also injected money, injected wages, and so on. And so that's how, by sort of jumping in and solidifying the banking system, the economy was able to take off again. And you have to remember, the U.S. at the time was the leading, the largest and the most dynamic economy in the world. And because of the Fordist Revolution, or whatever you want to call it, Second Industrial Revolution, as some people call it, the U.S. was primed to really take off. And so if you could solidify the financial system, if you could inject some government spending, some stimulus into it, off it went. And what's amazing, and this is really unknown, is that the economy in the 30s, from 1933 to 1941, before the war ever started, was growing at about 8%, 7-8% a year, and at times hit right up against 10%, which is the kind of growth rates we associate with China in the 2000s. So pretty astronomical growth rates. And in fact, the economy had recovered fully by about 1939, depending on the measure you use, 1939, 1940, 1941. The economy had recovered before World War II hit, and yet the standard claim of historians and both conservatives and liberals and leftists is, well, you know, it was only the World War II that pulled us out of the Great Depression. And that's simply not true. The only thing that the World War II did was absorb the last couple million of unemployed that the New Deal was not able to do. So that was it fell short on that for various reasons I won't go into. But the World War II economy was, of course, absorbed a lot of people for the military, which shrank the unemployment rolls, and also massive deficit spending, much greater even than what the New Deal had dared do, because up until that time, deficit spending, budget deficits, were regarded as absolutely beyond the pale. It was something that conventional economics and capitalist wisdom rejected completely.
So, Dick, one of the things that comes to my mind as I hear you talking about this, we were talking about a huge crisis, economical crisis in 1929, and then all this revival of the economy and all the changes in the finances, laws and regulations. But when you tell that there were 15 million people that were employed, how the government could do that facing such a huge economical crisis? Because sometimes we think about changes that need to be done today, and they say, well, there is no money for that. Nevertheless, in this time of such a deep crisis, there were plenty of decisions to actually create all this revival of the economy. How it was done in the terms of economics?
Well, in several ways. I mean, one is that deficits actually are not a problem. They're stimulating. And we've been fed for many years a Republican right-wing orthodoxy that says you have to balance the budget. And Clinton actually did that because he's a neoliberal. But you'll notice that Republicans like Reagan and Trump have not balanced the budget. And you can see with the latest tax cuts under Trump, which created a huge deficit, it actually sustained the recovery here from the Great Recession for an extra couple years. It's kind of petering out, but it was actually quite stimulative. So you can do that. The other thing they did, of course, is the New Deal raised taxes, because in terms of their social programs, the programs for the people, trying to reduce inequality was a major target. And one way to do that, of course, was to reduce the wealth of the rich. So tax rates were raised dramatically. And with that, and with the recovery, tax revenues came pouring in, and the government had actually more money to spend. So it is true that if you're in a recession, spending money, especially in a recession, spending money does stimulate growth, which then yields more tax revenues. So that is somewhat self-reproducing. All in all, the New Deal, there's an estimate by the Federal Reserve Bank that the New Deal cost a total of maybe $650 billion in our terms, in modern dollars, which I think is a little low. It's probably more like $1.5 trillion. It actually wasn't as much as we imagined. So when we start talking about health care for all today and the Green New Deal, often the estimates of how much it will cost are kind of astronomical, and I find them somewhat hard to believe. The reality is we have a $3.5 trillion federal budget. Probably for less than 10% of that, we could have a major Green New Deal kind of stimulus program and pay for it easily.
This is Loretto Rojas and Cal Winslow, your host this morning, and this is KZYX, Mendocino County, listener-supported radio. And our guest this morning is Richard Walker, the professor emeritus of geography at UC Berkeley, and the author of the important new book, Pictures of a Gone City, Tech, and the Dark Side of Prosperity in San Francisco Bay. And let's get right back to it. Dick, maybe you could walk us through a program, say the TVA or the WPA, to give us a sense of the New Deal, what it was like on the ground.
Okay. Well, I'd like to come back to something like the TVA when I get to my third point about infrastructure modernization. I think it's important, after talking about the economy so much, to recognize that the New Deal, the kind of second pillar of the New Deal, was really taking care of the people who were desperate. Millions of people were desperate, unemployed, families were going hungry, and so on. And as I said, they did this great employment program, which was profoundly helpful to people. But they also they passed the first federal labor laws, which stimulated unionization in a huge way, starting from 1933 and then again with the National Labor Relations Act in 1935. And that had a lot to do with raising wages, where they demanded fair wages and prevailing wages in their contracting with private businesses. They created, as I said earlier, the minimum wage and so on. They also introduced the first safety net, which was unemployment insurance, welfare payments to mothers with single mothers with children, and, of course, Social Security, pensions, a systematic public pension system. They also were extremely concerned about the disadvantaged of all kinds. So they had targeted programs for tenant farmers, for African Americans, for Native Americans, for the handicapped, which is, I think, the first time there was ever any federal interest in the handicapped. And what they did for Native Americans was actually a major turnaround from everything that had come before. We can always get into the criticisms of what they didn't do and how they came up short, but what's amazing is how they were willing to overturn in one field after another. And so, along with their taxation and the rising wages, rising income, they shrank the inequality pretty dramatically, so that we went from the 1920s, which was the greatest period of inequality in U.S. history. Well, among white people, okay, forgetting slavery for the moment, if we can, and to the most egalitarian period in American history after World War II because of these changes they brought. And the last thing I wanted to say about that, which is when they really took seriously the idea of the whole person, of the public interest, the public good, and they prioritize investment in education, in health programs, invested heavily in recreational facilities. I mean, there's a good example. It's astonishing all the recreational facilities that were left by this done by the WPA in city parks, in national parks, in state and regional parks, and so on. I mean, a lot of the picnic areas we still use, or trails we still use, or ranger stations still in use, were actually built back in the 1930s when there's this massive upgrade of parks. And, I think they really believed you had to dress the whole person, so that the last kind of amazing thing they did was they did public art. They felt that public art was uplifting, maybe that's a little kind of patronizing, but that uplifted people to be and inspired them to be around beautiful buildings, beautiful parks, beautiful murals, and so on. So all those post office murals all over the U.S. and murals in city halls and so on come from the New Deal era. So it was really quite an amazing sense of what could be done to help the public, to help the common people, and give them a better life, not just higher wages, but a better life in a variety of ways.
So who decided which one of these programs would be done? This was, of course, naturally, it was a federal initiative coming from the White House, but then it was given to the states, the counties. How was that decided?
Yeah, that's right. And that's really important when we talk about the third element, too, the renovation and modernization of infrastructure. In the sense of the larger programs, I mean, where did the WPA come from, for example? Or where did the CCC, or where did the labor law come from? They all had slightly different origins because, again, it was a very catch-as-catch-can kind of evolution of ideas and programs. So, for example, Roosevelt personally had always thought you should get the young man out into the woods. And so he just created the CCC immediately by executive order, and it went on to hire 3 million young men. Something like Social Security or labor law, that was, went through long congressional hearings. It was crafted by, those were both crafted by commissions headed up by Frances Perkins, first woman, by the way, in a cabinet position in America. And that's much more like conventional big programs you might think of. WPA is interesting because they started an emergency hiring program for the unemployed in winter 1933-34, because the situation was so desperate. And then they thought, this is just temporary. And they terminated it. That was the Civil Works Administration. And they discovered by spring, after they terminated, that unemployment was worse and that people had really loved this program. And so they reinvented it as a WPA officially in 1935. after having learned a nasty lesson. So, again, the variety of where these things came from. They came from certain of his, of FDR's kind of ministers or advisors, like Perkins or Harry Hopkins, you know, pretty much invented the WPA and how it was going to operate. And other things had to go through a much more formal, long-term process of legislation and all. But your question was also, how did they operate kind of geographically, which I think is really important, and in terms of our federal system, which is so complicated, you know, it's not just top-down. We have all these layers of feds, states, cities and counties, and so on. And so what they did is they'd have a program like the Public Works Administration, which is putting out grants, or the WPA, and they actually asked the states, and then the states turned to their cities and counties and kind of opened up a bidding process. That is, every town, major town, every county, every city kind of said, oh, well, we really have been wanting new sewers, or we really want our roads repaved, or we really need that big dam to irrigate our crops down here in this valley. And so they all pitched these ideas to federal kind of regional administrators, who then in turn had, they had various rules of thumb about, is it poor, is it poor enough to deserve this, does it already have enough infrastructure or not, is it in a, you know, some of it had to be political too, because the West got a huge proportion of the activity, and the West generally supported Roosevelt. The South, interesting enough, although South for a long time, Southern Democrats did support the New Deal, they started losing interest as the 30s went on and getting more conservative again. And so the South, the kind of programs of the South were not as robust as those in the West. But overall, what's interesting is they kind of built what locals and states wanted. And if they built a building, for example, the locals would hire the architect. The locals would hire the contractor. The locals would say, you know, we want a city hall. We want it here. We want it to look like this. And then they'd hire, they'd get WPA workers or other workers that were largely local from the unemployed and put them to work, so that people actually saw, not only did they have buy-in because they came up with these ideas, and also they had to pitch in some money. The locals couldn't get always a free ride. They had to participate financially. And then they often saw their own young people, especially, but their own unemployed, working on the local park, on the local water system, on the local roads, so that there was this immense buy-in because of the kind of redistributive and kind of bottom-up aspect of how these projects were decided on and doled out. And they end up being everywhere. It's just amazing. You go to any small town, virtually any small town in California or around the U.S., and there will be some school building, some old courthouse, or a park that was done by the New Deal.
So, in other words, you're saying that our Fort Bragg here in Mendocino County could say, look at our schools are in shambles. We need to modernize them and make them safe for the kids. We need some money for that, but it's hard to tax our locals, so we could reach out for help?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think there's two really important points here. One is that the locals feel that they participated and therefore had buy-in, and that this was a geographically redistributive program. Today, one of our worst problems is the concentration of economic dynamism in the very largest cities and the decline of small towns, rural areas, and even small industrial cities. And those are precisely who needs to be targeted for new schools, new infrastructure, and economic revival. Well, that's what the New Deal did. I mean, they saw there was a lot of rural poverty. I mean, the situation wasn't any different then. The cities were by far the most dynamic part. There was a lot of resentment of the cities, New York always most of all, and the rural areas were suffering. The small towns were suffering. The backwater counties were suffering. And the New Deal addressed that. It really gave them something. And in political terms, that turned out to be really important.
So you also mentioned that all these big programs and movements created a revival of democracy. Could you touch
right.
that topic for us, please?
Yeah, that's my last point after my economic revival and programs for the people and infrastructure modernization. You know, we tend to forget we tend to forget our history in general. We're Americans, as Henry Ford so wisely, history is bunk. And because we forget our history, we forget the very valuable lessons of it. And the crisis of the Great Depression had really, you know, this is the biggest threat to capitalist, commercial values and hegemony in American history, since the Civil War. Ruling class values, and really put in doubt the prevailing ideologies that the market was the best. When left alone, let the private investors decide for themselves. So it put that in jeopardy. And it left these people, so many millions of people who were desperate. Well, I think as we know today, following the Great Recession, desperate people are open to, first of all, to hunting for solutions when they feel that the ruling class, the elite, have neglected them, have ignored their problems, and don't feel their pain. And, of course, they're also, can be subject to the kind of lies and distortions and paranoia and fears propagated by ultra-right-wing and fascist leaders. Well, today we throw around the word fascist somewhat liberally, maybe too much, but those were real fascists back then. In Italy, was very successful under Mussolini as of 1933. He was very, very popular. He was popular in the U.S. With not just Italian immigrants, but with lots of leaders. For example, A.P. Giannini, the head of the Bank of America at that time, was a big admirer of Mussolini. Even Hitler had his admirers. There were lots of capitalists in particular who felt that, he was putting the radicals and the communists and the labor unions in their place and really leading a dynamic economy. And as we know, in Germany, the industrialists fell in line with Hitler because, hey, it was bringing, revival of a moribund economy and bringing them lots of business and profits. Well, some of our capitalists, led by people like Henry Ford, were actually very much kind of fascist sympathizers. There were fascist rallies. There was a giant fascist, out-and-out fascist rally in Madison Square Garden, New York. And then there were other kind of American homegrown movements, like Father Coughlin, who was one of these early radio jockeys of the right, preaching around in the Midwest. And he had millions of followers on radio. So there was a lot of unrest, and not good kinds of unrest, lots of very scary unrest. And there were a lot of liberals. One of those famous liberals of the time was Walter Lippmann, a newspaper columnist and writer. And some of those guys, like Lippmann, they wanted Roosevelt to just take emergency powers. This was such a crisis. We got to save capitalism. We got to save the country. So just become a dictator for a while. And he wouldn't do it. So I think what's really interesting about the New Deal is, first of all, Roosevelt personally had no interest in that. I mean, he was a politician, and he loved, you know, the spotlight and his popularity. He was a master of positive radio propaganda for the New Deal. But he basically believed in democracy, and he basically believed in helping the people through the kind of ordinary channels of American government, but pushing it farther than it had ever been pushed before, but without breaking it. He went to Congress for almost all the major legislation. And in fact, he got very heavily criticized when he tried to expand the Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court was rock rib reactionary, like it is today, in fact, as it has been through most of its history, and overturned some of his key legislation, declared it unconstitutional. But boy, when he tried to do that, that was not too popular. So, he had to work within the limits. This is really before the creation of the modern national security, the war apparatus. We didn't have a permanent war apparatus the way we do today. We didn't have a national spy, several national spy agencies. So it's a little trickier now, but I think the lesson is that it mostly depends on the goodwill and the good sense of the leadership, and it also they have to be leaders. You know, the fact is that in dire times, people, the mass of people in a democracy, not only are they swayed, but can be swayed in good and bad ways, but, they very reasonably are looking for leadership, and they turn to the government. When the markets have failed, the capitalists have failed, who is going to help you? And it's that willingness to use the levers of government and to act. Roosevelt never said, I'm a socialist. He never made an outright declaration of anything more than saying, I'm going to give you a New Deal, which is about as vague as you can be. But he kept coming up and accepting ideas and coming up with ideas and putting out new programs, feeling something's got to work, kind of throwing the dough against the wall to see if it sticks. And that works. That's okay. And so when people are afraid of the term socialism, I'm not sure in America we can sell it, democratic socialism, but what we can sell is pragmatic, reasoned, and, energetic responses to people's real problems, rebuilding their communities, helping their kids not become addicts to Oxycontin, limit drug prices and assure health care, rebuild schools and pay teachers decently. These are all very doable things. And I think the great lesson of the New Deal is if you have the right outlook, and you have the right leadership, you can do it.
Thank you so much for that answer. Very informative. If you are just joining us this morning, this is Loreto Rojas. I'm here with my co-host, Carl Winslow, in our program talking about California. Our guest this morning is Richard Walker, Professor Emeritus of Geography of the University of California in Berkeley. This is KZYX, Mendocino Community Listener-Supported Radio.
So, Dick, you talked a bit about the response of the right to the crisis, to the right of the New Deal. What about on the left, and in particular the working class movements?
Right. Well, I think absolutely central to the success of the New Deal in every way, politically and in terms of inequality and of helping people, was, the working class was at the center. Now, some of that was just the way, that was the hand that history had dealt them, because working class movements and labor organizing had built up dramatically in the early 20th century, been beat down in the 20s, but was ready to come back, to sprout back. And they went along with it. They encouraged it. They said, under federal law, as early as 1933, unions are legal, And here, and they created a set of rules. Whereas, you know, unions had often been considered, both ideologically and literally, de jure, to be illegal and against all the rules, some kind of interference of the free market. So unionization really took off. Now, part of that was because of the economic conditions and the desperation and the growing militancy of the working class in those conditions. But, you know, we should never, usually on the left, we're really in favor of kind of the spontaneous theory of union organizing. You know, if it's from below, that's really authentic. If it's too much from the leadership, that's not so much, not so good. But the fact that you could say, that organizers could say, your president wants you to join a union. And, you know, it wasn't too far from the truth. And that helped a lot. So the unions built up. They took a big jump after 33, and then another big jump after 1935. And then, years, the unions started to play a very important role in lobbying for things like Social Security and retirement pensions and so on. And so they became a major force, and the working class really, you know, voted en masse for Roosevelt in 1936. After he'd been elected by a good margin, 33, mostly because people were so fed up with Hoover's inadequate response to the Great Depression. But by 36, Roosevelt became probably the most popular president in the history of the country. And that's because of what he did for the working class.
We have seen a change from those laws of the workers, no? Those have been changing through the years.
Oh, yeah, there's been a dramatic erosion of workers' rights under neoliberalism since the Reagan administration in the 1980s. So, yeah, it's much harder to organize. It's much easier for companies to bust unions, which they have been doing for the last 40 years. So unionization rate is way, way down. And for a long time, people kind of no longer, there was no inspiration in the idea of the union movement. But it's come back, and we have these key strikes by teachers and so on, and others around the country that indicate people are fed up. And you know, some of these occur in the most Republican states, like Kentucky and Oklahoma. And so unions are really important, and they are a bulwark of democracy. There's no question about that. They have a lot of flaws. Everything has a lot of flaws. But the unions have been extremely valuable. They raise wages. That's been proved again and again and again. They give workers more protections, more security. And this is something that's really missing today. There's a political education that goes on in unions. And a lot of it's really good because a lot of the organizers in unions, even when the union may be fairly stodgy at the top, a lot of the organizers are young and more radical, and they talk to the workers directly, and they educate them, and you know, unions get out the vote. And that stuff is not insignificant in terms of not having this kind of rootless population. You know, we know about how many rootless young men who, you know, don't have lasting jobs, who feel really alienated from society, who are on social media with their fantasies and go out and shoot people. This is not a great model. And part of it, of this kind of social anomie and isolation, is the lack of unions. We tend to talk always about, well, the breakdown of the family or community, which is true, but the breakdown of unions has had a huge political impact and social impact. So the New Deal really grew, it depended on the unions and aided the unions. So it was a very virtuous circle right through the 1930s.
Let's take up, if you will, a couple of the criticisms of the New Deal, some of which are circulating as we speak. What about the criticism that the New Deal was basically for whites only.
Yeah, this is false. This is absolutely false. I mean, the New Deal happened back in the 1930s, and it's very important to judge historic epochs by their time, by their milieu. What was progressive in 1930 is not the same as what would be progressive today. We've learned a lot. We've come a long way. There have been social movements. There's better science, all kinds of things. And a lot of the New Deal programs, in hindsight, you can criticize. I mean, I grew up, before I was a lefty, I was a kind of radical environmentalist as a young man. And, you know, that taught me to, for instance, hate dams. Well, the New Deal really unlocked the dam-building era around the U.S., and it produced a lot of great electricity, which was good for industry. It electrified the rural areas with the Rural Electrification Administration. But in the end, they did a lot of damage to the rivers. Okay. Same thing with, say, rapes or treatment of Native Americans. There was a guy named Collins who they crafted a reform package for the treatment of Native Americans and gave them much more tribal autonomy and respect, and ended a lot of these horrible old programs that tried to, you know, whiten the Indian and turn them into white farmers and so on. It was, nonetheless, somewhat patriarchal, you'd have to say. You know, kind of well-meaning white elite approach that we wouldn't do anymore. Now, when it comes to African-Americans, which I think is, you know, it's always been a difficult subject because American racism and white supremacy has been so severe. The fact is that in 1930, this was a totally white supremacist nation, and 90% of the white population thought that was just fine. And when Roosevelt and the New Deal came in, they actually had a leadership that was rather markedly anti-racist. Roosevelt himself was mostly a kind of politician, a very probably middle of the road on race. But Eleanor Roosevelt, his wife, Harry Hopkins, Harold Ickes, Perkins, these were all very outspoken anti-racist. And in most of the New Deal programs, like the CCC, WPA, there were explicit anti-discrimination clauses written into them. You had to hire everybody. And as a result of that, the relief labor had a proportion of African Americans that was about equal to the proportion of the population. So it benefited enormously African Americans. Now, when they set up CCC camps out in the boondocks to work in parks, and especially in the South, well, guess what? The local people said, oh, no, that's got to be segregated. We can't have black boys and white boys working together. So they had to segregate them. But then people look back and say, oh, see, they were segregated. The New Dealers must have been racist, which just wasn't the case. So there, the only one clear case of really horrendous, I think, locking in race, well, probably two, but one of them is the redlining under the FHA, Federal Home Administration, mortgages, which through and after the war locked in residential segregation by claiming that mixing races was a financial risk that would undermine the solidity of the mortgages and so on. And it was that had been promoted by the National Association of Real Estate Boards. And unfortunately, the New Deal agencies, the HOLC and the FHA that worked on housing, got in bed with the National Association of Real Estate Boards, who actually, their people actually wrote the rules of redlining. And that didn't turn out well, no question about it. And, you know, looking back, you'd have to say, where were the New Dealers? Why wasn't somebody keeping an eye on this? But it was, you know, it was very clever, and it's also part of the longer history in America of public-private partnerships in which the capitalists, the business people, have inordinate power to shape policy. So, I mean, another example that had no bearing on race particularly was the crafting of Social Security, where there were corporate bigwigs who got in there on the commissions and the committees and testified and helped shape Social Security and our pension system, so that America, instead of getting a universal pension system, got a pension system linked to your employment, something we're still fighting over. Also with health care insurance, same thing. Very American, very much crafted as a kind of partnership between government and business. Okay, then the New Deal did not overcome that either. So there's a lot of things that they didn't get completely right. There's some things they got wrong. But overall, their record in terms of helping African Americans, helping Native Americans, and even Asian Americans in the West was remarkably good. And the result is a series of the early origins of the Civil Rights Movement. Many of the key leaders were actually participants in New Deal agencies, people like Mary McLeod Bethune and Marshall, the great Supreme Court justice, and so on. They were participants in the New Deal. And black people in general, despite what modern critics would say, they so loved Roosevelt and the New Deal that they started voting 90% for the Democrats and have ever since. And it seems to me that ultimately that's the greatest evidence for the fact that black people did not feel that the New Deal was racist. They felt that the New Deal did them a lot of good.
Thank you so much, Richard. This is so very interesting. It's obvious the relevance on this period has had in our history. But now that we are almost 100 years ago, what are the learning lessons that we have? How we resonate with the New Deal nowadays?
Well, I think without going back to a lot of details here, you know, I think boldness works. And we're constantly, the ideology of mainstream liberalism is, oh my God, you know, that's too expensive. Oh, that's too far out there and so on. And you see this in today's politics with the criticism of people like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. Oh, it's just too daring. Well, sometimes daring is actually better and works better. And what we know, because of the New Deal, is that that kind of boldness actually works. When people feel that the government is working for them, when communities that feel neglected, forgotten, feel the government is actually paying attention to them and listening to them and doing things for them, then you get a political mobilization and a kind of sense of renewal. And I think if the one thing I would say about the New Deal, to sum it up, is that it was actually a program of national renewal. And from the economy to democracy, from inequality through the basic infrastructure of life, roads and parks and schools and so on, the New Deal was a massive program of renovation and renewal, and it was one that brought people in. People felt that they were being served. They felt that they had a stake in it. And the result is, of course, they loved Roosevelt so much they elected him four times, and the Republicans had to see to it that that would never be done again, so they limited presidents to two terms thereafter.
So, Dick, we're just about out of time, and for both of us, it's been a great pleasure to talk with you. We've got plenty to think about. I think our listeners will as well. Maybe we haven't done this. Maybe you could direct us, the listeners, to your website.
Oh, absolutely. It's very simple. I mean, you can just Google Living New Deal, or you can go to livingnewdeal, all one word, .org, and there we are. And we have quite an amazing website. There's more information than you can shake a stick at. But right at the center of it is our national map, and it's really quite fun to look at that. And you can easily locate yourself and see what New Deal projects are nearby wherever you are. And you can do that on your phone as well. So livingnewdeal.org. Yeah, please come visit and get our newsletter and the various announcements. We do a lot of programs that I think people up in the North Coast would be very interested in.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's very interesting. I have seen the maps, and it's quite fascinating just to walk, for instance, San Francisco, following the places and learning more about our history. Thank you so much for being with us today, Dick, and hope to talk to you soon again.
Well, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So in 2 weeks, we are going to talk again, this time about the Green New Deal with Gray Brekin, the author of Imperial San Francisco and Farewell to the Promised Land. He is the founder of the Living New Deal project. Also wanted to remind you that I, Loreto, are also doing another program, but no worries, I'm not leaving Cal alone on talking about California. But I'm adding more, and I'm hosting a program with Diana Coriat. The name of the program is Mendo Latino. And this is a bilingual program, mostly in Spanish, where we cover very important topics. And we are going to take your calls on the air. The next program is about the census 2020. So please tune in also for Mendo Latino on Monday, March 23rd at 9 a.m. Estamos haciendo un programa en español con mi colega Diana Coriat. Se llama Mendo Latino y vamos a hablar sobre el censo 2020. Este es un tema muy importante para todas las personas que vivimos en los Estados Unidos. Por favor, escuche nuestro programa el lunes 23 de marzo a las 9 de la mañana y vamos a recibir sus llamadas telefónicas con preguntas.
Good morning and talk to you soon.
This has been Talking About California with Cal Winslow and Loreto Rojas. This is the second of a 5-part series they are doing about the Green New Deal, alternating with Mind Body Health on Tuesday mornings at 9 through April 21st. Stay tuned now for Loose Cannon Classics with Susan Jewell.